Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Today, President Trump holds two rallies in West Virginia and Indiana. He's spending the remaining days before Tuesday's elections blasting the Democratic Party and stumping for Republicans in tight Senate races. Here's the president last night in Missouri.
The Republican agenda is the mainstream agenda of the American people. It's how we all got here. The greatest movement in the history of politics in our country. It's about you, not about me.
Let's bring in our Friday Politics Roundtable. Sahil Kapoor, Bloomberg News national political reporter, is with us. Hi, Sahil.
Hey, good to join you.
And Brian Bennett, Time Magazine senior White House correspondent. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Jeremy. Hi, Robin.
And
hello.
Brian, which party has the edge right now?
Gosh, it's really hard to tell. I mean, I guess you look historically, the Democrats have the edge in the House. Given the potential for a wave there. But some of these races are getting very, very tight. And it looks like we're going to have a lot of surprises on election night.
Sahil, what do you think?
Democrats have the edge in the House. They're favored to win a majority. And Republicans have the edge in the Senate. They are favored to hang on to the Senate. It is a Democratic year. There's more Democratic enthusiasm than Republican enthusiasm, which is why Democrats have a good shot at the House. That and upscale suburban districts are likely to decide which party is in control. And in those places, there are lots of college-educated women who have moved away from the Republicans. But for the Republicans, their saving grace is that they have a very friendly Senate map, which suggests that unless there are major surprises, they are likely to hang on to their majority.
Okay. Well, I want to ask you both. I mean, Brian, I want to know what you think the surprises are. And Sahil, you mentioned college-educated women. We want to talk about that. But one of the reasons analysts are saying that they are maybe getting disenchanted is the way the president has been just lobbing spit bombs on the issue of immigration. He had that campaign-style speech in the White House yesterday, a place observers say is usually reserved for, you know, nonpartisan announcements. He said he plans to sign an order next week to deny asylum to people who ask for it in the U.S. but don't come through the traditional ports of entry. They cross the border elsewhere. And he also threatened that U.S. troops, the 15,000 he's saying he's going to send to the border, would shoot migrants.
Anybody throwing stones, rocks, like they did to Mexico and the Mexican military, Mexican police, where they badly hurt police and soldiers of Mexico, we will consider that a firearm.
So, Brian, take that up. First of all, illegal border crossing by executive order, the president says he's going to deny asylum to them. That defies an international treaty that says people can claim asylum wherever they cross. And what is the concern about 15,000 U.S. troops who were just given permission to shoot immigrants?
Trump has decided that he wants to hit a really divisive issue right before the midterms. He's made the calculated assumption that that is going to help get out Republican voters in districts all over the country. It's been interesting to see the arc of this. Trump was promising a fight on the wall months ago. He decided to put that to table that when the Kavanaugh nomination was in trouble and the Kavanaugh nomination came through. So instead of having a spending fight on the wall, he's decided at the last minute here to make these promises to stop asylum seekers and stop the migrant caravan that's moving north, and he's doubling down on this divisive rhetoric. And the question is whether that helps enough of his supporters get to the polls or cuts against him and mobilizes Democrats against him. But we're going to see a big test of the president's style on Tuesday, and whether his willingness to be really divisive can pay off at the polls.
Well, Sahil, I want you to just weigh in on that just briefly, because we also had when Brian says stop the caravan. The caravan is 800 miles away. And he also brought up birthright citizenship, saying it's ridiculous. This country is the only one that grants it to children born to non-citizens in this country. But there are 30 other countries, so it's not even true. There's a long list at this point. Some are saying it's a Hail Mary, but some are saying, no, it's really working.
He is hitting immigration from all angles because he believes this is a good issue for him and for his party. He believes it will fire up the Republican base of voters, as, by the way, he did in 2016. This issue did work well for him then. The electorate this time around could be different, and if there is a backlash, a sufficient backlash among Democratic-leaning voters, particularly Hispanics, then it could work against his party. Now, it should be noted that the nexus of immigration and crime that the president keeps trying to paint is not based on facts. The undocumented population in this country has been mostly flat since 2007. There's no evidence that illegal immigration causes an increase in violent crime, and there is evidence that first-generation immigrants commit fewer crimes than native-born Americans. So he's playing he is appealing to emotion and to impulses and not to reason here.
And that appeal is going to be really tested in West Virginia, where the president's going to be tonight. It's a race. It's the Senate race there between incumbent Senator Joe Manchin and the West Virginia Attorney General Patrick Morrisey. Trump carried the state by 40 points. And so right now the polls are showing the voters leaning slightly toward Joe Manchin, which would be really interesting to have a lot of – you'd end up having a lot of people who voted for Trump come out for Joe Manchin. And it would be a test of whether voters feel like they want divided government at this point.
So one of the races that everybody's been watching all the way along is the Senate race in Texas between Ted Cruz and Congressman Beto O'Rourke. And I noticed we were just talking about the so-called caravan. Ted Cruz today tweeted a question. He said reporters should be asking Beto O'Rourke if Beto O'Rourke's campaign dollars are illegally funding the caravan being allowed to cross illegally into Texas. There's no evidence for that. But it makes me wonder, Sahil, whether Cruz is really worried that he could lose this race, even though he's been up in basically every poll.
The race has been tightening in recent polls, and yes, Senator Cruz has consistently held a lead, I think, in virtually every poll that's come out, but he is taking this race very seriously. He is not assuming that he has it in the bag simply because Texas is a red state. It is a red state, reliably voted for Republicans. It's been a long time since Texas sent a Democrat to the Senate, but the uncertainties of this year and the wild cards are significant enough. And President Trump only won that state by single digits, so it has been trending toward Democrats. What Beto O'Rourke needs to pull this out is a big, big turnout among Democrats. He needs to run up the score among Hispanic voters, of which there are many in Texas. But again, he is the underdog. It is a Republican state, and Ted Cruz, as the incumbent, is probably favored.
Yeah, one more thing I want to ask about. The Democrats, as we've been talking about, want to focus on health care. And the Republicans and President Trump have been saying that they will protect pre-existing conditions. Brian, many of these Republicans voted to get rid of the Affordable Care Act, which is what gives the protections for pre-existing conditions. And there are a number of Republican attorneys general around the country who are actually suing to get rid of that. And then they're campaigning and saying that they're going to protect pre-existing conditions. What do you make of that? And what are voters hearing?
Well, I think the Republicans have realized that this is actually a vulnerable issue for them. And so President Trump is leading the charge to try to come out and say, oh, actually, we care about pre-existing conditions, even though the record shows otherwise, multiple votes by Republicans to strip it away. And also the fact that Trump's own administration lawyers in Texas right now are involved and have filed in a court case that would strip away pre-existing condition protections. So, you know, I think that it's an indication that they realize that the Democrats have been making some traction with voters on this on the health care issue and that they're at the last minute trying to claw it back.
You know, I'm jumping in to say I've been sitting here, Jeremy, thinking, how do you do that? How do you say your opponent is funding a caravan when there's absolutely no evidence of that? Or, you say that your party is preserving something that they voted to take away. But this is what's happening this year. And Sahil, we were just talking about the Texas race, Cruz and Beto O'Rourke. And I want to speak about something that sort of dovetails with that, which is another issue that's been percolating up, which is support for white nationalism. Big issue now for Iowa Congressman Steve King. At a forum yesterday, he blew up at a questioner. I mean, there's been a lot of accusations against his, you know, rubbing shoulders with white nationalists. But at a forum, he was asked about meeting with far-right activists in Austria.
Yes, but do you identify as a white
supremacist? Sir, stop it.
Then why don't you meet with the white supremacist organization?
Sir, that's it.
In Austria?
They're done. Okay. I would ask whoever is guarding this door to leave this man out of the room.
Yeah. Now, Sahil, this is how we swing back to Texas Senator Ted Cruz as Steve King throws somebody out of a room there. You asked Ted Cruz about King. What? Tell us about that.
Well, so Ted Cruz and Steve King have been allies and friends for a while. Steve King, of course, was the co-chair of Senator Cruz's 2016 presidential campaign. And King has obviously been getting a lot of blowback for his embrace of white nationalists in places like Canada and in Europe, and for his rhetoric that has been denounced as racist. And I reported a couple of days ago that Ted Cruz called Steve King after he was asked about Steve King in Texas. And what Senator Cruz said publicly was that he was disappointed in King's rhetoric and he called it divisive. Now, King told me that Cruz's call, Cruz essentially indicated support for him in the call. It was a supportive call. But beyond that, the details are a little bit murky. The Cruz campaign told me that it was a personal call.
Okay. I want to ask each of you for a one-word answer.
What word
is the one state that you're going to be watching on Tuesday, Brian?
Georgia.
Sahil?
Arizona.
Interesting. Yeah. Right. Martha McSally and Kristen Sinema running for Senate there.
And in Georgia, is it the governor's race?
Yeah, the governor's race. Okay. I think it's going to be a really interesting moment.
Okay. Well,
I'd also add Florida as an honorable mention because there are two fascinating ones there.
I want to just throw in Pennsylvania just because we like them. We'll be watching all of them with all of you. Thank you so much. Sahil Kapoor, Bloomberg News political national reporter, Brian Bennett, Time Magazine senior White House correspondent. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
The UN is warning that 13 million people in war-torn Yemen are facing starvation. But for many, it's already too late. You might have seen that picture of the starving 7-year-old girl in the New York Times, a photograph by Tyler Hicks. She looked to be just months old. She was so emaciated. Well, her family says Amal Hussein died yesterday in a refugee camp in northern Yemen. Yemen was first racked by an internal struggle when the Houthis toppled the government, but it's now a proxy war with a Saudi-led coalition backed by the U.S. fighting the Houthis, who are supported by Iran. Lise Doucette is the BBC chief international correspondent. She joins us from London. And Lise, you've been in Yemen. I know you're familiar with this photo. The paper said readers kept asking, how is she? How is she? Now she's died. Your thoughts about how at least this picture has brought some new attention to this horrific conflict.
It was a bold decision by the New York Times to put square and center on the front page of its edition in the United States, but also its international edition, the terrible, terrible picture, a searing image, as you mentioned, an emaciated 7-year-old Amal. Amal in Arabic means hope. But anyone looking at that photograph would have really struggled to find hope. And the New York Times said, you can choose to look away, but we decided we had to put these pictures because it's not that Amal is the worst of the worst, is that there are many more Amals who are dying in what is now being called an ignored war. Mm-hmm. But at last, the country being described as the world's worst humanitarian crisis, and as you say, a proxy war, is getting attention. Is it because of the gruesome killing of the Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul? Is it because journalists like Tyler Hicks and Declan Walsh of the New York Times and my colleague Orla Geeran and her team got through finally after years of trying and after years of being stopped going by the Saudi-led coalition, which doesn't allow journalists to go there with the planes on a flight into the capital, Sana'a? And is it because we have learned time and again that in order to arouse the sympathy of people, there has to be a name, there has to be a face, that there's many psychological studies done about how masses of people, if you see images of masses of people suffering, starving, being torn, you know, being caught up in a war, people find it very easy to have a sense of hopelessness about it. But if you personalize it, humanize it in some way, in the same way that it was the little Syrian refugee boy, Aylan Kurdi, watched up on a beach in Turkey, that got far more attention than all the other images before it. Mm. Whatever the reason is, we now have, for the first time, the U.S. Secretary of State, the U.S. Secretary of Defense, calling on the Saudi-led coalition, the most powerful player being Saudi Arabia, its partner, the United Arab Emirates, and also calling on the Houthis backed on Iran to seek a ceasefire within 30 days. This is unprecedented in this very tortuous war.
Well, let's talk about that, because, again, you mentioned Jamal Khashoggi and the uproar over the realization that his death was at the hands of these Saudi agents. And Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman was more than likely giving the order there. And you do have, as you say, the U.S. now calling for this ceasefire. What do you think is the likelihood of that happening? Because we're also reading that there are many who hope there's so many ties between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia that this will just blow over and that he will be allowed to continue his campaign in Yemen and that there won't be any ceasefire. What's your sense of what's actually going to happen there?
The crisis over Jamal Khashoggi and this absolutely atrocious murder of a journalist on sovereign Saudi territory in Istanbul has shone a new light, a very harsh light, on what's been happening in Yemen. The architect of that war in Yemen is the Crown Prince. It was one of the first things he unleashed when his father gave him the job of Minister of Defense. He had boasted at the time that it would be over within weeks. It's now more than 3 years, and Yemen is now on the brink of utter total collapse. There is a sense, and certainly what we're seeing now with the statement by the United States, which was backed up also by Britain, that there will be greater pressure on the Saudis, on the Emiratis to come to the negotiating table. It won't be easy to get a ceasefire in Yemen. Even the UN envoy for Yemen, Martin Griffiths, a former British diplomat, has said that a full ceasefire may not be possible, but we need to head in that direction. So there may be more pressure to move in that way, but there are also rumors that the Saudis and the Emiratis may make another military push to get the key port on the Red Sea held by the Houthis before there's any serious talk of a ceasefire. So there is a sense that something will happen on Yemen, but whether it's enough to bring the suffering of Yemenis to an end and this war to an end is another question. But there is hope, at least, that it will begin to ease the abominable situation in which so many Yemenis live.
That's the BBC's chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette. Lise, thanks so much.
Thank you.
A story now about a movie that failed but is getting a second chance at life in a new form. Jupiter Ascending was a sci-fi spectacle directed by the Wachowskis. They're the siblings probably best known for The Matrix, which had a huge impact on sci-fi movies. Jupiter Ascending, however, was carved up by critics and lost millions of dollars when it came out in 2015. But as Tim Grieving reports, a piece of the film has been salvaged and reborn as a ballet.
Claudia Puig echoed many film critics in her USA Today review of Jupiter Ascending.
It was outlandish. It was pretty loopy.
A movie that features Channing Tatum in elf ears and eyeliner, sent to protect Mila Kunis as a galactic Cinderella. In fact, 3 years later, she's still at a loss.
There were so many reasons, mainly because it was just an incoherent story. When it did try to follow some kind of a plot, it was pretty laughable.
The film died a quick, expensive death at the box office, and has mostly only lived on as memes mocking Eddie Redmayne's inexplicable performance.
My mother taught me what was necessary to rule in this universe.
Like killing people?
I create life!
One of the casualties of Jupiter Ascending's fall was its score by Michael Giacchino. The Oscar-winning composer of Up and many of today's biggest film franchises, from Star Trek to Jurassic World, had worked with the Wachowskis previously on Speed Racer. Giacchino said the sibling filmmakers gave him a chance to compose a film score in a completely different way.
They said, we had this idea, why don't you write the entire score before we shoot the movie? Essentially, what we decided to do is write like a symphony about Jupiter.
The composer worked from the set, costume, and character design, and the script, and he had much more time than normal to write a film score, 3 months.
I had a bit more of a chance to really flesh out the ideas that I wanted to work with. Normally, everything else is first guess, best guess, and you hope for the best. where this was, I was able to develop the ideas. And I think that's part of the reason why it feels more of a piece, more of something that you could just listen to on its own.
Which is why it was such a bummer when the film came out to a rotten reception. But then a few years later, Seattle-based ballet dancer and choreographer Kyle Davis reached out to Giacchino.
I would be very quick to probably say he is my favorite composer.
He wanted to know if his favorite composer had any short concert works that Davis could choreograph for his company, the Pacific Northwest Ballet. Giacchino sent him the nearly 40-minute Jupiter Ascending Symphony.
The first time I opened the files and listened through, movement started showing up in my head immediately. And that's how I was able to go, yes, this is what we need to work with. This is exactly what I want.
Davis says Giacchino's music lends itself to dance, and this piece suggested an idea for a story.
I don't necessarily need to have a strong narrative, but having some sort of abstract guidance through the music of what might be happening is really helpful.
Davis came up with the ballet A Dark and Lonely Space. 26 dancers represent various parts of the cosmos, from planets to fundamental forces to cosmic dust.
The concept that I went with after hearing the music was the anthropomorphization of the birth of a planetary system. So it's definitely sci-fi.
This may be the first time the score for a bad movie, at least in the majority opinion, has been converted into high art. Michael Giacchino doesn't agree with critics about the film, at least not on the record, but he's glad to see his score find life off the screen.
All of these things you create are in some way your kids, you know, and some of them get abandoned, and some of them don't, and some of them are well-loved for whatever reasons. They will live forever. So it is nice to see, like, this one kid who was kind of kicked into the corner being let out and being able to play again.
And Eddie Redmayne can't screw it up this time. For NPR News, I'm Tim Grieving.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Today we got the last official snapshot of the economy before the election. The Labor Department reports U.S. employers added 250,000 jobs in October. That's twice what it was in September. The unemployment rate is unchanged at 3.7%. That's the lowest level in nearly 50 years. Let's bring in NPR economic correspondent John Idsty. Hi, John.
Hi, Jeremy.
And this was better than expected.
Yeah, very positive report. Strong job creation, good wage growth, and more workers joining the labor force. That said, part of the reason job creation exceeded expectations was the bounce back from September when Hurricane Florence dampened job growth. We saw a big rebound in leisure and hospitality jobs that were hurt by Florence. So if you take the average of September and October job growth, you get a little over 180,000 jobs a month, which actually is a little bit below the recent trend.
It seems like one of the big problems right now, actually, is that employers aren't able to find the people to fill the jobs. We heard from the Labor Department recently that there are more than 7 million jobs open currently and 6 million looking for work.
Right. Yeah. You know, the main explanation for that is a skills mismatch. Many of the job openings need different skills or higher skills than are available in the market. Lots of industries are affected, including education and healthcare and business and professional services that includes tech. Also, Americans have been much less willing to move to take a job, and that may be another reason these jobs aren't filled.
What about wages? In October, they grew by 0.2%, overall 3.1% for the year. Is this what we should expect in terms of wage growth, or should it be better than that at this point?
Well, as you said, over the past 12 months, hourly wages have risen just over 3%, and that is the best yearly showing in nearly 10 years. So it's a good sign for workers that after a decade of sluggish growth, they're finally getting some substantial wage growth. Many economists think the wage gains will continue to improve, but that rapid acceleration of wages isn't imminent. And 3% annual wage gain is below what we've seen in the past when the economy is this strong.
So a lot of people are going to be watching the Fed, and I'm sure the Fed is looking at these numbers and deciding what to do. We know President Trump has been saying the Fed should not be raising interest rates. We just spoke the other day on the show with former Fed Chair Alan Greenspan, who said he's never talked to a president who wanted interest rates to go up.
No,
but what do you think the Fed sees with this number?
Well, I think the Fed sees a very strong economy where the wages are moving up at a more rapid clip. And at the same time, inflation measures are at the Fed's target and pretty well contained. So I think Fed policymakers will probably stick to their gradual rate hikes and maybe boost rates again in December.
And what about the election? You know, people say it's the economy, stupid. What do you think this means, this jobs report, for the midterms on Tuesday?
Well, it's the positive economy is a plus for Republicans. But today's report, I don't think will have much effect. The Wall Street Journal took a look at whether there's a connection between the unemployment rate and the number of seats a party wins or loses in the midterms. And they found no matter what the unemployment rate was, the president's party usually loses seats in Congress during the midterm election.
John Itzde, NPR economic correspondent, with a look at today's jobs report from the Labor Department. John, thank you.
You're welcome.
The New York City Marathon is Sunday. More than 50,000 runners will line up at the starting line, among them American Shalane Flanagan, who won last year's women's race, the first American to win the world's largest marathon since 1977. But there's another champion you might want to keep your eye on this Sunday if you can. She is fast. Last month, Jeannie Rice, a 70-year-old Cleveland grandmother, set a world record for her age group of 3 hours, 27 minutes, and 50 seconds, 7.5 minutes faster than the previous record. She joins us from Cleveland. Jeannie, so you ran Chicago, you're about to run New York. What happened to recovery time?
Well, it's been 4 weeks, so I'm pretty much recovered, yes.
Well, let's just say that people who set world records like that maybe take a little bit more time, but off you go to New York. So congratulations, first of all, on Chicago. You are a serious runner at this point. You knew how fast you were going. You knew the pace you were setting. What did you think when you realized how much you'd broken the record?
So I figure a 70-year-old record, I've been looking at it, and it was 3:35. And I know I already ran 6 minutes faster, so I figure if I can stay healthy, I know I could do it. But wouldn't you know, this past April, I went to Boston. It was cold, windy, and rain. So I didn't have a good run there. And top of that, I fell, so I hurt my knee from falling. Mm. And so it took me 5 weeks to recover. So I didn't know what I can do this year after all that injury. So 3:35 was in my refrigerator. I look at it every day. This is a world record.
You had it posted on your refrigerator.
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh my goodness. So you had you had run several races. You had several injuries, but you knew that it was possible for you to run 3:35. 35 is kind of a magic number for you. Talk about how you only started running at the age of 35. After, I understand, going home to your family's native South Korea, visiting relatives who wanted to fatten you up. You gained a few pounds. You said, "Let me take up running." A lot of people take up running. When did you decide to become such an elite runner, to be so competitive?
Well, the first when I started running, just to lose a few pounds, and a friend of mine at the time, she was a runner, and she talked me into doing 5-mile local race. And she was third, and I was right behind her at the race. And that was it. And since then, she never beat me. And very following year, I decided to run a marathon. So I did Cleveland Marathon 3:45. That was 35 years ago. Mm. And that fall, I did Columbus 3:16. I shaved almost 30 minutes.
Wow.
And same year.
Wow.
And that's when I was qualified for Boston.
I mean, I just, mm-hmm. it's so fascinating to discover about yourself later in life that you have mm-hmm. the makings of an elite athlete. And mm-hmm. we understand now marathoning has taken you around the world.
I decided to run all over the country, so I've gone to New Zealand and Great Wall, Dublin, London, Madrid, Paris,
so cool.
Prague, and, you know, Iceland, and Stockholm. And I think it's part of running, and I mix with a vacation, so I get to see other country.
So you're very much in the world of masters sports, which is it's a great world. You know, it's people who do travel around the world. They are very competitive. Mm-hmm. They're very athletic. And you've discovered what many of them know, which is it's so great to get into a category. So now you've entered the 70s and, you know, you can win more when you're the youngest in the category. But I'm just wondering, do you ever think, wow, it's wonderful to be a grandmother of two and discover this and discover this community in this world. But what if you had started running when you were young? Do you ever regret that you didn't?
Well, I'm from Seoul, Korea, and they didn't have a sports for girls.
Right, right.
You know, and I wish...
They didn't even make girls' sneakers.
No.
Right.
There's somebody here in this area. He coaches other, you know, younger people. And he did mention that, I wish I got hold of you years ago.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure, you know, if I would have then, if I was really, could have run faster, I don't know. But I got faster, and then, of course, as I get aged and got a little bit slower, but last couple of years, I'm getting faster again. PR is 3:12, but that was, I was in my 40s.
Your personal record, yeah.
Yeah, but most exciting was, for me, Chicago. I knew if it's the weather is good, and I knew I could do it, 3:35. I want to mention one more thing, Ryan.
Please.
I'm 70 and over, of course, and I looked at the 60 and over, how their time was. There's only one person beat my time, was Joan Benoit Samuelson.
Joan!
Yes, yeah. She's the only one, and she's been my, you know, idol all these years.
An Olympian.
Gold medal.
Yeah,
yes.
The Olympic gold medalist.
So I was more excited about that than world record, because she was the only one beat me 60 and up.
Well, Jeannie Rice, you're heading into the New York Marathon this weekend. What do you have on your refrigerator now?
Well, New York Marathon, I just want to win, first of all. And, of course, my, you know, second goal is I want to beat my own time. I think I could do it. And Chicago, actually, last mile or two, I slowed down a lot. And I have to work on that one. So I could have done 3:25 or better.
Yeah, you're such a slacker.
So I do have my goal, my own goal. Now I have to beat my own record.
You want to beat 3:35, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the lady had it 5 years, and I beat it by 7 minutes. So hopefully this will be there for a while, but only I could beat it, I hope.
Well, Jeannie Rice, again, who last month set the world record for her age group, the 70s, at the Chicago Marathon, shaving 7.5 minutes off the previous record, heading into New York Marathon this weekend, hoping that she's the one who breaks her record and wins that race in the 70 age group. Jeannie, best of luck to you. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Well, back to the other big event coming up. We're spotlighting important ballot issues around the country on Tuesday, Election Day. In Oregon, voters are already deciding with mailed ballots whether to keep that state's decades-old sanctuary law. As Oregon Public Broadcasting's Conrad Wilson reports, a law that once had bipartisan support isn't seen that way anymore and may be repealed.
Oregon's sanctuary law is one of the oldest in the country. It was signed into law more than 31 years ago.
Both Republicans and Democrats voted for the bill. It was really non-controversial.
Rocky Barilla was the Democrat and state representative behind the law. It says no law enforcement agency can use its resources for the sole purpose of detecting or apprehending people whose only violation is being in the country unlawfully. Put simply, it limits local and state police from enforcing federal immigration policies.
To be honest, this was not meant to be a sanctuary law. It was meant to protect local city resources.
And also to reduce racial profiling. California's sanctuary law is similar to Oregon's. 5 other states and hundreds of counties also have a form of sanctuary policy. Now voters in Oregon are being asked if they want to repeal theirs. Supporters of the law say it establishes trust between immigrant communities and law enforcement. They've rolled out a series of ads urging Oregonians to vote no on what's known as Measure 105.
Current law helps create bright lines for local law enforcement. Communities that we serve know that we're focused on protecting and serving them. We're not worried about their immigration issues.
That's Sheriff Mike Reese speaking in an ad. He's the sheriff of Multnomah County, where Portland is the county seat. Law enforcement officials in more liberal and urban parts of the state are lining up against repeal. But half of the state's sheriffs, largely from more conservative rural parts of the state, want to do away with the law.
Politicians have protected illegal aliens with dangerous sanctuary policies that put Oregon citizens at risk. It's time to stand up for safe communities.
That's an ad paid for by the Federation for American Immigration Reform, a group that wants to restrict immigration. This repeal effort got underway after Donald Trump was inaugurated. Cynthia Kendall started collecting petition signatures last year.
The problem is that a law that was passed in 1987 to curtail racial profiling is now being used to shield people that are in our country illegally.
Kendall defended the repeal during a debate this fall. She's the president of the group that petitioned for repeal, Oregonians for Immigration Reform. Kendall has called immigrants who are in the country illegally an assault on American culture and has portrayed them as dangerous.
We are recycling criminal aliens, putting them back on the street so that they can inflict their damage yet again.
She's referring there to high-profile cases of violent offenders who were in the U.S. illegally when they committed their crimes. Research shows immigrants commit crimes at the same level or less than native-born Americans. But it's the same type of argument President Trump and his supporters have been making more vocally leading up to the midterm elections. A recent poll in Oregon found neither side of the sanctuary law repeal had a majority, and 20% of voters were undecided. For NPR News, I'm Conrad Wilson in Portland.
The final season of House of Cards is out today on Netflix, this season anchored by Robin Wright after Netflix fired Kevin Spacey following multiple allegations of sexual misconduct. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans is here. Hi, Eric.
Hi.
So Kevin Spacey's performance as Frank Underwood really defined this show, and the show itself addresses that. Here's Robin Wright's character, Claire Underwood, Frank's wife and now the president, addressing the audience directly.
Are you still there? Do you miss Francis? Here's the thing. Whatever Francis told you the last 5 years, don't believe a word of it.
How does the show work without Kevin Spacey?
Well, you know, I think a lot of the criticisms that people had about it from its last season with Spacey, that it's too convoluted, that it's not particularly realistic, that a lot of the notes that the show hits, we've seen season after season after season, and you're kind of tired of them. I think a lot of those criticisms are still valid in this new season. But the biggest thing about changing out Spacey for Robin Wright is that Kevin Spacey's character, Frank Underwood, was somebody who really relished in his own sort of villainy. And so he was a very compelling anti-hero who sort of made you complicit in some of the stuff he was doing by turning to you and saying, hey, can you believe I'm getting away with this now? You know, kind of thing. And just by the nature of the character, Claire Underwood is more reserved than that. And because of the way the story unfolds in the first two or three episodes, she keeps the audience at kind of an arm's length because they don't want to give away what she's doing. And so just by the nature of that, I think the show is less compelling because she's not reveling in how she's getting away with things or turning to you and saying, hey, you know, look at how clever I am. And so she's not as compelling an anti-hero, to me at least.
The other thing, Eric, that's different is that this show started in a very different political era than the one we're in now. In fact, the show hasn't really been on the air for much of the Trump administration. The last episode of the last season was back in 2017, right after President Trump had come into power. How does the show address today's political issues?
Well, that's another criticism I have of the show is that it doesn't portray the extreme partisanship of our current era. One of the messages of the show, I think, is that these people are all chasing power, whether they're Republicans or they're Democrats. And Claire Underwood and Frank Underwood are sort of the master manipulators who glide over the top of it. Now, the problem with that is that our current political times are very different. Everything's very colored by partisanship, and nothing can really happen in Washington without facing the reality that it is almost impossible to get large numbers of members from one party to support an initiative by another party. So that reality doesn't exist in the House of Cards universe, and so it feels like it's an alternate universe. It feels not quite real. And you now have the situation where Claire Underwood is the first female president of the United States, and she is hated by a large segment of the population. Mm-hmm. And we have a clip that kind of sums that up. Let's check it out.
I am not the first president to face threats. I know with Frances, sometimes there were several a day. Is it about the same, what we're dealing with here?
It's significantly up.
By how much?
There are roughly four times as many threats on any given day since you took office. Now it's twice that since Frances died.
I thought everyone loves a widow.
Well, not if she's also commander-in-chief, I guess. These are not rational people, Madam President.
So the voice you hear is her vice president, who was also her chief of staff, kind of telling her what the deal is with these threats. So as the new season begins, this is a female president who's under a lot of pressure. The public doesn't seem to like her. And there's all these rich, wealthy power brokers who are lining up to cash in promises that Frank made mm-hmm. to them before he died. And so she is trying to assert her own independence. And that's sort of the dynamic of the early episodes.
It's hard to remember this, Eric, but this was a show that was basically Netflix's first big show, House of Cards. And now they have, sure. I think, 1.5 million different shows that they're doing. But should they have ended the show after Spacey was fired? Why did they bring it back?
Well, what they've been saying is that, you know, the show employs a great many people, and they were in production when this happened, when these allegations against Kevin Spacey surfaced. So part of it, you know, they're saying, you know, these people were all planning on being employed in the final season, so they wanted to finish the show out. They had a story all planned out. And so I think they wanted to try and give Claire Underwood her due mm-hmm. And just subtract the Frank Underwood character from the stories they'd already planned out. Now, I've only seen the first five episodes. I haven't seen the last three. But my sense is that it feels like the show has run its course, and maybe they should have thought a little more about just stopping when they had to get rid of Kevin Spacey. But for diehard fans of the show, I think they'll enjoy getting one last taste of House of Cards. And I'm still hopeful that the last three episodes will elevate the show's game enough to make us all feel that it was worth seeing a final season.
And maybe then there'll be a spinoff called Claire, a la Rhoda from the Mary Tyler Moore Show. Eric Deggans, NPR TV critic, thanks so much.
Always a pleasure.
Rhoda. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.